Oh, I should mention, if you, that'll get picked up by the microphone, the noises of the paper. Okay. How did you choose drums as your instrument?
Oh, well, I guess I did it when I was in the service. You know, when I was a kid, I was playing congas up until I was around 16, and then I went to the army. I continued to play in the army, and I went into the army band, and I started playing snare drum in the army. And when I got out of service, I just continued on with it.
What kind of music did you play in the army band?
Oh, I played jazz with my congas, you know, like in the small bands. But in the big band, we play like military parades, classical music with the large concert orchestra. Then out of that came a small dance band that we played like in the officers' clubs and non-commissioned officers' clubs. And then I would sort of like play jazz like off post, like with a lot of the civilian players.
Did you use anything from the military music? Did any of the drumming rhythms from that carry over into your other music?
All the drumming rhythms are the same. It's just like where you place them and how you play them. I mean, the basic drumming is rudiments, which is a basic army beat or parade beat or whatever you want to call it. So like basic snare drum is a military sound. It's like rudimental drumming. And you take that, and I mean, that's for like more or less for like exercises. And then, you know, jazz is improvising, so you use all that and you know, and do whatever you want to do with it to make it come out, you know.
At what point did you start becoming interested in free playing?
Oh, that started here in Philadelphia. Well, you know, here, I was listening to records, I was listening to people like Cecil Taylor, John Coltrane, Ornette Coleman, and people like that. And so here in Philly, right before I left, I had put a band together using two drummers and two bass players, that whole thing. My brother, Muhammad, was playing the other set of drums. He lives in Paris now. He's been living here for around 12 years.
What kind of thinking were you going through when you were like redefining your role of a drummer to one of, like, you know, rhythm section, timekeeper, to a constant improvisation, to free playing?
Well, to me, you know, like, I've always been very much into keeping time. I mean, that's the drummer's first gig, you know, in order to take the instrument and to keep a time with it. And when I wanted to play more freer, more looser, then I would play the time more loosely, you know, and I would keep the idea of what I was doing with the time. I mean, I wouldn't play it on the instrument, but I kept it in my head, and I still do. Like, I'm always playing some kind of a time, but I'm playing so loose on the instrument until it has to be more or less felt than heard. I developed that right here in Philadelphia, and Before I started playing really free, I was playing quite a bit here in town. But when I started playing this free type of a drum, then the gig started getting less and less here in Philly, because didn't nobody really want to deal with playing free music, and a lot of the club owners, they didn't really hear it. The musicians were cool. The musicians knew what was happening, but a lot of the club owners didn't want to hear it. So I went to New York with it, which was a more open place, it was more music there and more people with different ideas about music, and more club owners or more people with clubs who accepted different ideas of music. So it was a bigger town for me to sort of get my fantasies off about playing free. And I got there, and I did very well the first couple of years I was there.
How did you meet John Coltrane?
Well, met John Coltrane. Actually, I met John Coltrane here in Philadelphia first. And I talked to him a lot, you know, and about the way the music was going and the way things seemed to be going with the music and the way I wanted to play the music. And he And he was the one who really advised me to leave Philadelphia and try it in New York because it was a more open place. And after about a year, I took his advice and I left and I went there. And upon going there, the very first gig I got when I got there, it was like 2 days after I got there, I started working with Pharoah Saunders and Don Cherry and Gene Perler played bass. And Jane Getz, I don't know if you heard of Jane Getz, she played piano. And I mean, immediately when I got there, I started working. And I worked with them, with that group. And then I started running to people like Paul Blay and Albert Arlen, Marion Brown, Archie Shepp. And I started working with these people. And Coltrane was always on the scene. He would, sometime I would even catch him in a couple of the concerts that we played, checking us out, because he was the kind of a person who checked everything out. He didn't let too many things get past him. He was really looking for different things to play all the time. So he was always checking out the new musicians and seeing what was happening with the music.
When did he invite you to record with him?
Oh, he invited me to record with him right after I had started going over to the Half Note, because he was playing over there. This was around 64. He was playing over the Half Note a lot. I mean, in fact, he had the Half Note whenever he wanted it, actually. It was just the Tamini brothers owned the Half Note at that time, and it was located at Hudson and Spring, downtown around where I live at now. I live on Spring Street now, but he was about a couple blocks over. Anyway, they would give Coltrane the place, and he would work it, you know, like 2 weeks sometime, 3 weeks sometime, maybe a month. When he didn't have anything, no work to do, he could always work in his club in New York. In other words, that was like a home base club for him. And he would come there, and I went there a couple of times, and I sat in with the band and played with the band. And he offered me to make some tapes. And I didn't really know what the first offer came. He said, would you like to make some tapes with me? And I said, sure, you know. But at the time, I was, you know, I really wanted to play the kind of music that I wanted to play. And he wanted me to play with another drummer at the time. And I didn't really feel up to it. I wanted to more or less get, you know, I had all this stuff built in me. I just wanted to play it. And so I didn't really want to play with another drummer. So I missed the first recording. It was weird. The first recording was Extension. And all my friends that used to go down and sit in with Train was on that record except for me, because I didn't want to play with another drummer, which was Alvin Jones at the time. I just wanted to play on my own. And so I missed that date behind being, you know, obstinate or whatever you want to call it.
Do you regret that now?
Sort of, you know, because
it's kind of history-making session.
I wanted to play on that session, and I didn't really know that was what he was talking about. He said, hey, you want to make some tapes of me? I didn't know he was talking about a session. And so, like, all those guys got on that session. I was off for the session because I was trying to stick to my guns. Like, I wanted to play by myself. I had been playing with him, so I was really up there about it. But the second time, you know, when he called, well, he didn't call me. I called him the second time because he went out to California and he took Pharoah Saunders out there with him. And when he came back to New York, I got on the phone and you know, I said, hey, you know, hey, you took Pharoah out to California. Could I come down and play with you? And he said, sure. He said, in fact, you can bring your drums down and make the gig. He said, but there's another drummer on the gig, you know. I said, that's fine with me, you know. It doesn't really matter. And so I went down and I played the gig with Alvin Jones, and then I started recording with Train, and it worked out. The first recording I did with him was Meditations. That was the first one. And I sort of kept my cool after that, you know.
Let's listen to a selection from Interstellar Space, which is a duet with him, and we're going to hear Jupiter. Do you want to tell us a little bit about how this session was recorded?
Yeah, well, Jupiter was, it came out of Ogundi. I think it was on their album Expressions. That was the first recorded music that I did with Coltrane, just playing drums and horn. Well, it didn't start that way. First, the whole ensemble played, and then everybody dropped down and just Train and I played. And so behind that, Train got an idea to do, like, some duo things just with drums and horn. And this record happened. I wasn't quite prepared for it, but after listening back to it, I mean, you know, like, that record's about 10, maybe 12, 13 years old. I don't know. And after looking back on the record, I found out that the record's good. I don't think I could have played it any better. But a lot of times, like I feel that I could have done a much better job on a lot of those things that they were Coltrane, because now, I mean, well, you know, it's impossible, but really now I really know the direction I'm doing. I really know what I'm doing as far as drumming is concerned. But at that time, I was more or less experimenting with trying to put a sound together on the drums. And Coltrane definitely helped me do that, because I was thinking of a way that I could play and be able to play in tempo without holding a tempo. And he was very interested in that kind of work. So he really helped me develop that kind of a playing. And now, you know, I listen to it now, and I kind of dig what's going on with it now. But I still feel like, you know, that if we could do it now, I would be a little more satisfied.
Let's listen to a selection from the album Interstellar Space with John Coltrane on tenor and Rashid Ali on drums, and this is Jupiter.
Yeah.
A duet with John Coltrane and my guest, drummer Rashid Ali, from the album Interstellar Space, and that was Jupiter. Rashid Ali will be playing congas in a concert this evening at the International House at 3701 Chestnut Street. And also playing will be Michael Carvin, Calvin Hill, Sam Rivers, Fred Simmons, Harold Smith. And this concert is this evening at 8:30 and 10:30 at the International House. When you were playing with Coltrane, would you talk about an album or a piece before you'd either perform it or record it?
Well, sometime, you know, Coltrane was really hard to get in one place to talk about music, because seemed like he was always in a hurry to do what he had to do. Those last years that I was working with him, I don't know, he seemed like a man possessed, man, on trying to get to whatever it was that he wanted to get to for some reason. And it was hard to nail him down. In fact, one time I can remember that I got him to come into town for a rehearsal, just once. I can remember that. So the music was always spontaneous and on the spot done. I mean, he would, like, write a piece, you know, and he would write out for everybody. We go into a studio, especially into a studio, he would write the piece out, and he would give everybody their parts, and we would run it down a couple of times, and then we would print it, and we would play it, and he believed in actions more than words. In other words, he believed in just working the music out and playing it right in public, you know. He would give us the music, and we would record it first. Most of the time, we recorded the stuff we did. And then the next performance, we would play the stuff out for people. And a lot of times, it was rough, but as it goes on, like as the concerts or whatever clubs we were playing in goes on, it would turn out to be really in there around, say, if we start a club, say, maybe on a Wednesday or a Tuesday, by Friday, or by Thursday, we'd have it down. If we did a concert series, maybe the first concert wouldn't be musically that good. I mean, this is something that the musicians knew. I mean, the audience, they couldn't really tell if we were messing up a tune or not, actually, but we would know it, and we would tighten it all up. By the time the second set or ever the concert come, we would have it together. You know, he worked it like that. We very seldom rehearsed the music.
What kind of markings would he have for you, the drummer?
Oh, he would just write out the music for me. A lot of times he wouldn't write it. He wouldn't write the drum charts out, but he would write the lead sheet or whatever. I would use the lead sheet or whatever it was, just to familiarize myself with the music, and all the fills and everything that went in. It was on me to do that. He just gave me the space to do it in, you know.
Do you have copies of the records that you recorded with him?
Records? Yeah, I do. The ones that I have, they have some out that I don't have the copies of. Like, they have just recently, they just released two records in Japan that I don't have.
What effect did he have on you personally? Did he have any? Because I know a lot of musicians feel that
Yeah, he taught me. He taught me a lot personally, musically, and personally. I learned a lot from the man. I mean, I learned how to. I learned how to control my actions. I learned how to listen more, and not talk so much. And I just learned how to respect people and other musicians and the music that they play, and more or less how to handle myself in situations. Because before I got with Coltrane, I was pretty rambunctious cat. You know, I didn't give people a second chance. You know, I felt like it was hard for me to learn how to play, and so I don't have time to deal with the person. If they can't do it, they can't do it, you know. And he taught me a lot of different things. Like, for instance, just like one instance, when I was working with Coltrane at the time, and there was a guy that I used to play with. I mean, well, I thought he could play okay, fairly good, but not really good enough, you know. And so I did a couple things with him in the past. I did a couple things with him. So, like, when I was working with Coltrane, he asked me, you know, hey, I'd like to sit in with Coltrane. Could you arrange it? And I said, hey, man, I don't really know if you can or not, you know, because I didn't really feel that musically he was ready. And he asked Coltrane somehow. I don't know how he asked Coltrane, but in the dressing room, Coltrane approached me and said, hey, you know, this saxophone saxophonist out there, he asked me to let me sit in. You know, he said he used to play with you a little bit, you know, and on the strength of playing with you, he asked me to sit in. What do you think about him? I said, well, I don't really think he can deal with what's happening on the bandstand. So he said, oh yeah? I said, yeah. So we got out there to play. You know, the very first thing he did was call this guy up. The very first thing he did. And I was surprised, you know. I mean, after I had said the cat wasn't really there, he called the guy up, and he played. And after the gig was over, you know, we was back in the bandstand. He said, you know, I called the guy up. He said, he said he might not played everything right, but there was a few things there that I liked, a few things that I heard him play that I liked. All he have to do is, like, sharpen him up and get himself together, he could probably get to play the horn pretty well. You know, and I felt kind of weird, you know. He said, you know, there's always something. If a person is playing something, there's always something that they can do in there that's good that you would like, you know. So that sort of pulled my coat about things. Like, I'm not so quick to say, hey, you can't play, you know. I listen to everybody now and learn. I listen and learn. And that's what I like about Coltrane. As great as he was, I think he learned something from everybody, you know, because he didn't have a closed ear to things. He was always open and able to listen and to hear things. And that taught me, in a sense, I think I'm a better musician behind that now, because I'm an open musician and I listen to everybody, and I don't judge people. I don't make judgments on them, on what they're doing. I just listen. And what I like, I like. What I don't like, I don't like. But, you know, at least I keep it to myself.
Did you find yourself taking stock of your life when he died and trying to figure out what your next direction was going to be?
Yeah, well, I was pretty at a very low point when he died. It came as a surprise to me, as a matter of fact. It might seem strange, you know, being around a person as much as I was around him, because he never really complained about anything, but he was having a problem with his liver, you know. It was on its way out, really, you know, from his old days, you know. And because he was a completely clean musician, like, from the time I met him, he was drinking juices, he stopped smoking, he was doing a lot of things, but I guess it was just too late for him to get back, you know. But he had got the message, and he was into religion, and he wasn't into a certain kind of religion, I might add. He was into a different, all kinds of religions. He believed in whoever was believing in whatever they believed in, as long as it was the same God we all believed in, it was cool. And so he was cleaned up a lot. He was really trying to get himself together. But I think it was a little too late, you know. I have pictures of him. Like, when we was in Japan, I took a lot of pictures of him. You know, I had a camera, and I was just taking pictures. And a few of those pictures, I noticed that he would have his hands, like, in his hole in his liver, sort of like that. So he must have been in some kind of pain. But the man never really said anything except that he might say that he was a little tired. And I can understand him being tired because the pace he was putting himself through, you know, on those days, I mean, we were in Japan, we was in the States, we was moving all around the States, and pretty soon he just stopped taking gigs in clubs and concerts, and was doing more concerts, which was easier work, you know, just one concert, and going into the studios, which he did a lot, you know, a lot of studio work. And so when he died, I was sort of surprised, but then when I look back on it, I can see that the cat was just being really brave out there because he was hurting. He was into a lot of pain, and he never told anybody about it. And he died from a liver ailment. You know, I guess his liver just stopped working, and his system just poisoned out. Because he died pretty fast after he went to the hospital. I heard he went to the hospital that night, and he died that morning from home.
So did you make changes in your life then?
Well, yeah, I went to Europe. That's what I did. When I first heard about him dying, I said, "Oh, well," because I know it wasn't going to be too easy for me because of the way I played with him, and there wasn't many people still accepting that kind of music here. So I cut out and I went to Europe and I stayed there for about as long as I could, about 3 months. I couldn't make it no longer than 3 months, not because of the music, but because of I just simply miss Philadelphia and American people. And so I came back. I went there, and I was accepted really pretty much in Europe. I got new drums. I traveled around. I played with a lot of different people. And I came back here because Alice sent for me. She wanted me to play a concert at Carnegie Hall with her. And so I came back here and played the concert at Carnegie Hall, and I just stayed here and kept trying to put music together, trying to put groups together, and still doing that now. But at least it's not under the shadow of Coltrane now. It was then, but now I'm more or less my own person now.
One of the things that you did was start a loft, which developed into a nightclub. How did that evolve?
Well, that evolved out of not having a place to play myself. You know, like here I was living in New York, and I could play, but I couldn't play any of the major clubs there for some reason. Now it's a little different because I'm working a lot of the clubs. But at that time, the music was still pretty much a new thing, and a lot of clubs wasn't accepting the kind of music there unless you had a big name like Coltrane or Sonny Rollins or something like that. And so, meanwhile, you know, when Coltrane died, when I came back, I did play with Sonny Rollins for about a year and then Jackie McLean for a couple of years, Earl Father Hines. I was working, you know, busy with different groups. But when it came to my own group, I guess my name wasn't big enough or whatever. I didn't have records of my own or whatever. So I couldn't get those gigs. So out of frustration, I opened up this loft that was right underneath me. I live in this sort of like a factory building. And it was a loft on the first floor that the landlord had. It was like a rag place where he had a lot of rags. He sold old, new rags and materials. And so he got a little too old for the business, and he closed business, and I got the place from him. And so me and friends of mine, I mean, this is all actually coming from me. Friends of mine and friends, we cleaned the place out, painted the place up, built a lot of stuff in there, and got carpenters and all kinds of stuff, and hooked up a little small, like, not small, it was a big space, and hooked up a loft for playing. And so I played in that loft exclusively with the band. And, in fact, with people right here from town, like Freddie Simmons playing piano, Jimmy Vass played alto saxophone sometimes there, Sonny Fortune sometimes played there. A lot of different people played there. But I was usually playing drums most of the time. So I hooked up this gig, and I played there for about 2 years straight. I mean, people were coming out to see me, too, and I was really happy about that. We played there for a couple years. And we built a clientele happening. People were coming, and more musicians were coming, more people were coming, and it started building. And it got to the point when I had to start bringing in other groups, you know, because I was playing there all the time. I mean, I played there for like 2 years straight. And so we got a, we developed into a restaurant and a liquor license. We got a liquor license, we got a cabaret license, and we got everything that we needed to open up a full-fledged club. And when we opened up the club, naturally, we had to start bringing in different musicians and different bands and different things like that, you know. Jackie Byrd had his band there for a while. Frank Foster had a band there. The Loud Minority was there for a couple years. Jackie Byrd was there for a year or two. Trumpet player had a band there, too. I can't think of his name there. He played with Andrew Cyril. And anyway, he had a band there. And plus, we had a lot of small bands like Philly Joe Jones, Elvin Jones, Archie Shepp, Pharrell Saunders, different bands, my band. But then I wasn't playing that much after we got the liquor license in, which was not the deal. You know, I want to play, you know. So, like, when we got liquor licenses, it turned into the kind of a place where it turned into another club, you know, like, just like the rest of the clubs, you know. But it was the only difference about it was my club. So I could play there if I wanted to, but it got to the point when I started looking for gigs elsewhere because everybody was, no, I mean, like, you know, you get a month of gigs here, a month of gigs here, and I couldn't put myself in every month. Felt like, you know, the guy said, hey, man, you're playing all the time, and, you know, I know it's your club, you know. So I started looking for gigs elsewhere, and I started getting them, like, playing different clubs, going out of town, playing different things. And the club lasted, oh, for about 4 years. And then pretty soon it really started taxing on me because I found myself not playing too much at all because this business thing was really getting to me, you know. Like, when the business is happening, it's happening, and money's coming in, you have to pay money out. So I got this tour to go to Europe, and it was about working the club or going to Europe on this tour, you know. And I didn't really have anybody to take care of that business for me. I really couldn't find anybody that really wanted to run a club. I mean, now maybe I could, but at that time I couldn't. So I temporarily closed the club down. I mean, temporarily closed it until I got back from Europe, and I went on this tour in Europe. When I came back about almost 2 months later, I still didn't really want to mess with the club because I had bookings and I had gigs. And so I decided to sell it, you know. And that's what I did. So I sold a club, and it's now called Dr. B's. It's a rock club, which is still going right now. And it fixed up a little different. And I'm satisfied because it still sort of brings income in for me. And I'm free to play more. So I don't think I ever want to run a club again either because I know a lot about it, you know. And so when I do work in clubs, I have an idea exactly about what's going on. And so I don't have any problem getting gigs, working in clubs and stuff, but the idea of running a club is a little taxing, and I don't think I want to deal with that anymore. I just want to play now.
Do you have a different view of the jazz business, and the music industry than
you
did before?
Yeah, I know about it. And, you know, with the record company and all that, you know, I know a lot about the business. And I just started divorcing myself from the business so much so I can get more into playing because that's where I'm really at.
What are some of the things you wanted to do differently in your club from the way other clubs were run?
Well, see, my club was ran by the musicians, more or less. And the other clubs are ran by a club owner who's not really into the music at all. But I had a club that when a band came into my club, my piano was tuned up and ready to go. They had a place where they can go off stage, you know. They had a dressing room. They had a place where they could be, you know, like when you come off stage, you just, instead of being pushed right on the people, you can go into your dressing room, you can cool out. you could eat. You can relax more in my club than you can in a lot of other clubs, because the emphasis is not on the music and the musicians in most clubs. The emphasis is on the business. The music is secondary. The musicians is thirdary or whatever. But in my club, the musicians and the music was first, and the emphasis on everything else was last. But it was comfortable because the people enjoyed themselves and the musicians enjoyed themselves. So I had a very successful running club, you know.
When you started it, it was at a time when there was a real loft scene in the Soho area.
Yeah, it was, because we had a lot of different lofts going on. I mean, Sam Rivers had a loft. Jody Wilson had a loft. That idea, Jazz Mania was a loft. Black Beans was a loft, which is still around. Jazz Forum is a newer type loft. They just closed recently.
What's left of that now?
Nothing. I think the guy who was booking and doing things at the Jazz Forum is now booking and doing things for the Village Gate.
But what's left of the loft scene? Do you think there is much of one anymore in New York?
Well, not really, but Jazz Mania is still hanging out. Black Beans is still hanging out. But it's not, that scene is almost finished. It's a different scene now, and it's not about, in fact, it's almost back to where it was before, except we have a lot of new clubs in New York now than it was before. A lot of new clubs has come up out of that. But the Alley was the only jazz loft that really went into a jazz club. Everything else remained a loft, like no liquor, no nothing. And you just go there and you play for a certain amount of hours and you come out. But the Alley turned into a club that was a legitimate club, and it was open till 4 in the morning, and we served booze and food and the whole thing.
I bet a lot of musicians miss it.
Yeah, but they talk about it still, you know. But the room is still there, so it's a possibility of us coming back, because I'm just actually renting out the room to these other people who have a real long lease, something like a 10-year lease. And so actually I still really have the place. It's just about if I ever want to do anything with it again. I don't think so.
Well, you still have your own record company.
Yeah, Survival Records.
We're going to listen to a selection from one of the records on it that you recorded with Leroy Jenkins.
Uh-huh, Swift to the Winds of Life.
Do you want to talk a little bit about your collaboration together on this record?
Oh, well, Leroy and I, we go back a long time. I mean, when he first came from Chicago to New York, I met him. And he was working with a trio there, Revolutionary Ensemble, I believe it was called. It was a trio. I met him, you know, doing that. In fact, that ensemble worked at Ollie's Alley and et cetera. And we got together we have been talking about playing a duo, just violin and drums. Or, you know, I've been into a lot of duo playing, because since I made this Coltrane record, well, even before that record, I was into playing duos a lot. And this Coltrane record sort of just made it a reality that everybody knows that, hey, man, Rashid Ali really plays good with just one other instrument. And so we got the idea of doing violin and drums. Well, I first got the idea to do one with Billy Bang. I don't know if you heard of Billy Bang. He's another violinist around. But then Leroy and I, we did it, and so we just sort of did it ourselves, too, man, you know, because I have this 8-track equipment, a lot of stuff. And we sort of just got in the club one day and locked the doors and stayed in there and turned on the machines and just played all day, and just until we got something that we really liked and had it pressed up into a record.
The piece that we're going to hear, The Stomp, has an extended solo by you. Can you tell us briefly what it is that you're thinking about when you're soloing for, say, three or four minutes in the middle
of the piece? What I'd be thinking about mostly is the music that I'm playing and the melodies and how the changes are running. And see, like, that's another thing. You know, a lot of people got me out there like I'm a free drummer, which I am. I'm definitely one of the free drummers, one of the newer type players. But I put a lot of emphasis on melody lines and a lot of emphasis on changes and a lot of emphasis on where the music is. And so I play like that. I play a drum solo because of listening to Max Roach. I think he's a very melodic drummer. And I think of myself as a very melodic drummer, too. So I usually play right in the structure of what's going on with the music. And if it's free, I play it that way. If it's not, you know. And I think you hear that in his thump.
Before we hear it, I want to thank you very much for doing this interview today. Thanks very much for being here.
Always a
pleasure. I enjoyed it.
Hey, glad to be here.
This is Rashid Ali on drums with violinist Leroy Jenkins. The piece is called The Stomp.